You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC, located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. They have been here since time immemorial, and as students with the privilege to learn and broadcast on this land, we are forever indebted to them. Hello, and welcome to a special two-part series called All of Us or None of Us, brought to you by the Gender Empowerment Collective under the radio show Intersections. Typically presented to you every 4 weeks, Intersections digs into topics surrounding gender, race, and social justice. This series will be exploring the intersection between climate justice and social justice. Specifically, we'll be discussing the topic of Black involvement within the environmental movement in Vancouver. This series is hosted by me, Tamwani, and I am a regular member of the Gender Empowerment Collective. But today, I'm joined by a very special guest, Maya. So, Maya, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey, I'm Maya. I'm also involved with CITR as a member of the Music Collective, and I am a co-producer for the music podcast Phone Bill. To provide a bit more context, we met through the Climate Justice Research Collaborative, which is hosted by the Climate Hub at UBC. The collaborative is part of a research course that is offered to undergraduate students as an opportunity to tackle issues of climate change and climate justice. We are essentially research partners, and our project is focused on the topic which we will be discussing today, Black environmentalism in Vancouver, BC. We want to give a special shout out to all the people who made this project possible. Huge thank yous to Adriana Laurent, who is the CJRC coordinator at the Climate Hub, and also the graduate students advisor and research professors who mentored us through this project, Dr. Connolly, Dr. Arfin, Tekla, and Andrew. When we first decided we wanted to look into Black environmentalism in Vancouver, it quickly became obvious that this project would definitely be a challenge, because although we are both Black and interested in environmental issues, we were also recent settlers to Vancouver and weren't really plugged into the environmental movement or the historical Black community in Vancouver, which we will add is very small.
Yeah, statistics show that although Vancouver is a very diverse city with a 40% population of immigrants and 45% of people who identify as people of color, most self-identifying people of color are actually of Asian descent, and only around 1% of local residents in Vancouver actually identify as Black. And the Black experience itself is very diverse. Gender, sexuality, nationality, skin tone, socioeconomic status, all of these factors contribute to someone's lived experience. Each individual's experience is completely unique, and we're just here to talk about the patterns and trends that we've seen regarding the Black experience in Vancouver. So if you walk around Vancouver, seeing Black people is quite rare, but people of African descent have actually been in Vancouver for centuries. When it comes to Black people, Vancouver suffers from a case of historical amnesia. There's been centuries of erasure of Black Canadian history, from slavery in the colonies and migration from the Caribbean and the States, both prior and after the Confederation, and even more recent migrants from the African continent. Black people are here and have been here for a while, yet there seems to be an absence of Blackness in the culture, in mainstream discussions, and just in general.
Some of this has to do with how small the Black population is, and part of this has to do with how dispersed the Black population in Vancouver is. In the early 1900s, a Black neighborhood called Hogan's Alley emerged. This was a vibrant East Side working class neighborhood located on the southern east edge of Chinatown, where there were Black-owned businesses that were home to Nora Hendrix, aka Jimi Hendrix's grandma, and this also attracted famous Black musicians such as Ella Fitzgerald and Nat King Cole. After years of negative press characterizing the neighborhood as the center of squalor, immorality, and crime, the city of Vancouver began demolishing homes in the late 60s in Hogan's Alley in the hope of replacing it with the freeway. The freeway was never completed, but the Black community of Hogan's Alley was permanently dispersed. No Black neighborhood of this kind has emerged in Vancouver since. The displacement of the Black community in Hogan's Alley has had compounding ramifications in housing instability, employment instability, and simply having a sense of community. This also raises questions about what could have been, What could have Hogan's Alley have been today? While I'm alone and blue as can be,
dream a little dream of me. For those of us who are black settlers, it means we don't really get a place in Vancouver that feels like home. There isn't really a block or street in Vancouver where you stop being the minority. You also have to be extremely intentional about finding community with other black people. Because we're students, we have a very specific experience of Vancouver. But even the black student experience itself isn't monolithic. We spoke with Malini, who is the VP External of the Black Student Union at UBC, who spoke to some of her experiences and her view of the environmental movement in Vancouver. Malini is originally from Bermuda, and she spoke to us about the differences she found from being in Bermuda to Vancouver.
For those of you who don't know, Bermuda is literally in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. We're a population of 65,000 and we're a British overseas territory. So under that ruling, so we're not independent or anything like that. We identify like with a lot of Caribbean aspects, but because we're not physically in the Caribbean, it's always like this struggle. But in terms of demographic, it's a 60-40. So 60% of the population is black and 40% would be white. And then we have like a large percentage of like expats or those that come from different countries, a lot of like Filipinos, Portuguese, and everything like that. So it's quite diverse, but then at the end of the day, our black population is kind of our foundation, make up the working class. And you will see that visually a lot around in Bermuda. So growing up there, I never really questioned my blackness, or I never questioned into what I was, because I didn't really have to, because I was just Bermudian, like I was Malini from Bermuda. And then coming here, I remember my first year of university, like some of the first questions I ever got was like, oh, what are you? And I'm like, I'm a human. I don't really know how to answer this question. And it was just really weird, because I remember I called my mom and I was like, they just kept asking me, who am I? Like, what are you? And I don't know what to say, because I am black, but like my grandfather's from Sri Lanka, and like I have people that are lighter skinned in my family, but still like black. So it was just interesting, because I felt like I got here and they were ready to push me in this box. But my whole life, like, we didn't really have this box when it came to race. So it was definitely a big difference and a big culture shock in that sense. But I kind of used it to my advantage. I kind of was like, you know what, like I'm black, but like, that's just only one part of me. So there's like, I'm Bermudian, I'm a woman. So I definitely think it's big. And once I got here, I feel like they really like amplified or emphasized my blackness, and especially my blackness as a woman. So that was definitely different, and something I kind of had to adapt to and kind of had to gain confidence in. But yeah.
All right, well, can you speak a little bit like more to your experience as like university life, and what's that been like for you? I mean, we're all UBC students, so what would you say? I guess you can't speak for like all black girls or all black people, but like, what is your personal experience being like a black girl at UBC and like university life in general?
Yeah, so it's definitely like, I didn't really see it as like, I still don't really see it as like being like a minority in the sense, and I know that's kind of weird to hear or kind of weird to digest and understand, but it doesn't become apparent to me until someone calls me out for it, like, oh my gosh, you're the only black person. I'm like, okay, yeah, because I think I've kind of just been normalized to it since being at UBC. So it's just like, you know, it's like you've just become comfortable with the discomfort of being the only one. Sometimes it's not even like the only black person, I'll be the only like non-white person or non-Asian person in the class. So I'm like even more of a minority, but it also like, that's what makes like black people different. That's what makes us stand out. That's what makes us like have this kind of confidence. I think we have, like, we walk in a room and we know that we are special and like, and everything like that. So it's definitely been different. But I joined UBC-BSU, I'm sure you guys both know about it, so the Black Student Union, back in first year as a member. And I kind of saw it as an opportunity to be part of like a community of people that looked like me. And also like, it was a comfort thing, you know, I grew up seeing that around me, and then I came here and it's the complete opposite. So that they really helped me in terms of like boosting my confidence. Like, hey, you're not the only one that's going through the same things. Like, we're all doing the same thing. We're all like hearing racial topics discussed in in like classes and you being the only person of color and you feeling uncomfortable, like it's definitely like helped in terms of like looking to someone and be like, oh, did you hear that? But yeah, it's definitely at times it can be like you do, like I do like feel the discomfort. But I also think like at times I kind of like just like brush it off and I'm like, whatever, like it's my life. So I gotta kind of live it in the sense, but I am like lighter complexion. And my sister is actually in her first year here and she is a Black woman as well. And she is darker. So it's always kind of funny to like, not funny, but to hear our different experiences, because even the way that like she gets approached or I get approached and the way we have our interactions. So in the sense, like I kind of have privilege. I kind of have like from a colorist perspective, I kind of have a bit more privilege, but at the end of the day, I'm still Black.
There's peng Black girls in my area, cold, dark skin, light skin, medium tones, pumping braids, got mini afros, thick lips, got hips, some of us don't, big nose contours, some of us
won't. I'm kind of interested because you said like you've been like acclimatized or in a sense to like being the Black person, but like you also mentioned the fact that, you know, BSU helped you with like your confidence. So I feel like there is that. Do you think that it was kind of a drop to your confidence coming from that, like being in the majority in like Bermuda and coming to Vancouver, where it's like so far from 60%? I don't even know, it thinks like 1% or less than that. So can we speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it definitely like, my confidence was always there. Like I was been confident in myself, but I think it more was like when I kept getting questioned or I kept getting like addressed, like, oh, what, like when I kept trying to be fit into a box, that's when I was like, oh, hold up. Like, what am I doing wrong? Like, do I need to change my ways? So like BSU, in which we're all Black, there's so much diversity within it. So like no one, like we all fit into the box of like, we're under the UBC Black Student Union, but we all have like our own lives, our own backgrounds. Like we all speak different languages. So I think it was like really encouraging to see like, hey, they're like Black, but they're also like lived in like England for like 50 years and speak with a French accent type of thing. So it's like, it kind of reassured me that like, there are people that are different. I'm not the only one that's going through it and they're still getting asked. So I'm going to still be asked. So definitely like, my confidence was low when I was like uncomfortable or when people made me uncomfortable about who I was or questioned who I was. But when I'm able to just sit here and stand here and be like, oh, yo, this is my life story, take it or leave it. Then that's when kind of like BSU kind of helped me, I guess, make that kind of bigger and kind of use that to my advantage.
Malini gave us an idea of some of the initiatives BSU is involved with and focused on. As VP External, she has an idea of some of the bigger goals BSU is focused on, including environmental justice and sustainability.
Yeah, so in terms of like our goals, they're pretty much, our main one is to create like a safe space for Black students and a community for them on campus. But like so many visions cover so much in the diversity of that, from like academic to social to like mental health. So we really try to broaden ourselves and like create as many resources as we can for our group. In terms of anything with climate and environmental justice, I mean, I'm sure you're aware we did a event with the Climate Hub back in November, I think, about climate justice and racial justice. So it's definitely one of our like climate justice and racial justice is definitely one of our biggest, like one of our big goals that we kind of want to address and kind of raise awareness for. Like personally for me, I always like was kind of unclear about the intersectionalities of it. So I thought it was like something that I needed to learn and something I needed to know more about. So like when I got involved with BSU and got in touch with people who were also in that area, I just like took it on myself to make sure that, you know, BSU can be a part of it, because kind of like you mentioned in the beginning, there's so much intersectionality and it's so, when you are kind of oblivious to it, you don't really realize, but it's so apparent how much they intersect and how much they're so important to each other. And without addressing one, you also have to address the other. So we definitely like, we've had initiative hands-on that focus on them both, but we've also had initiatives that focus on them separately but highlight like some aspects of it. So if that is like food justice or kind of raising awareness in terms of like policing and looking at policing and how policing has kind of affected climate protests and everything like that. So it's definitely, it was definitely an eye opener. And as VP External, I thought it was important that we raised the issue and brought it towards like our community, our campus, and even like for everyone to hear about.
Malini raised a very important idea, one that has been central to our research, and that is the idea of intersectionality. Intersectionality is an idea that was coined by the American legal scholar and activist Kimberly Crenshaw. In 1989, Kimberly Crenshaw wrote a paper in which she devised what we know to be intersectional theory. This term describes how the different aspects of an individual's identity, including gender, race, sexuality, class, etc., interact to characterize their unique lived experience. Her paper outlined the failure of both the anti-racist and feminist movements to acknowledge the compounded nature of the Black female experience, to recognize Black women as both females subject to patriarchy and Black people subject to racism. Her analysis bore wider implications for various movements and activist groups. In the current global political climate, the environmental movement, alongside other movements, has had to reckon more with the social inequities attached to climate change and environmental degradation.
George Floyd.
George Floyd.
George Floyd.
George Floyd repeatedly told the officers that he could not breathe after an officer knelt on his neck.
The family of George Floyd held a memorial in his memory.
My brother's gone, but the Floyd name still lives on.
I'm sure you guys are all aware of, of what happened last June in terms of like the police brutality and the big increase in awareness for like racial justice and the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think that was definitely a turning point for BSU as a club on campus, in which so many organizations reached out to us kind of wanting to know more, wanting to make an impact. And I think that definitely like solidified our presence on campus and our voice on campus. And as an executive team, it was encouraging to see because it finally felt as though like maybe Black students will be heard, not even on UBC, but in the world. And I'm sure you all hopefully felt the same way. But so I think it was, I don't want to put this in a weird way, but it was like perfect timing in the sense like we had all this awareness and eyes on us. So we were able to like be part of events that we were never able to be part of before, or even like collaborations that we always wanted to do or were in the works, like things were starting to actually unfold and be a part. So we've done so much. So I think we've actually done more than if we were on campus or in person, just because we have like the opportunity just to open up our computer and be like, let's do this event and let's do this collaboration, let's do this.
It would be foolish not to mention what has happened over the past year in terms of the United States coming to terms with a long history of police brutality. There have been countless police killings of unarmed Black individuals such as George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and more recently Dante Wright. These horrific acts of violence ignited protests around the world, including the city of Vancouver. In the summer of 2020, a letter was written to the City of Vancouver by Black Lives Matter Vancouver, calling against racialized violence and systematic oppression within the city. This letter included a list of demands, including the redirection of financial resources from Vancouver Police towards initiatives that support long-term community safety, such as childcare support, education, and mental health interventions. Black Lives Matter exists to hold police accountable for violence against Black people. They do so while standing in solidarity with the Indigenous people on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations, currently known as Vancouver. This letter didn't hold back in confronting the city, claiming, "For many of you acknowledging, for the first time, that Black lives matter, this comes with a pang of guilt, a realization of complacency and complicity in the face of ongoing state-sanctioned violence you thought was in the past. For others, this simple statement is an affirmation of our existence and our deserving to live and thrive."
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
As we speak of the importance of Black people thriving, we thought it's important to highlight the activists who are working towards that future. We spoke to Adriana, who is a Black climate activist in Vancouver. She is originally from Honduras and is a queer, mixed-race, half-Black, half-white immigrant who is passionate about the intersections of climate change, race, gender, and migration. She's been an active member of the climate youth and racial justice organizing community for 6 years now.
So I grew up in Central America. So I grew up in the Global South, feeling the impacts of climate change with droughts, with hurricanes, and just seeing like the environmental degradation of the impacts of like, you know, extensive agribusiness and mining companies in Central America. So that's kind of what sparked my interest in environmental and climate justice. So I've always had like from day one that justice lens to my work, just because of lived experience. And when I moved here 6 years ago, I moved here to come to UBC. And I joined the like kind of more environmental orgs and the environmental movement here. I started off with zero waste because that's what like was most common at the time, especially at like academic institutions. I think that was kind of the more mainstream conversations around sustainability and environment. I always like, I guess I can talk about this later, but I always tried to kind of talk about like, it's not just about recycling. It's like, we also need to talk about like, even if we are talking about recycling, we also need to talk about how like it's countries like Canada who ship their waste to countries in the Global South. So again, it is an issue of justice. Like, it's not just about like sorting your waste out at the station at UBC. But that's kind of where I started. And how I first got like officially involved, I guess.
Would you be able to sort of speak on these experiences so far? And could you tell us if you found it to have been generally an inclusive space, not only for people who share like your identities, but also people outside of your identities?
I think it depends what movement and where you're involved, right? Because I think, for example, if you're looking more at like the grassroots youth movement and the grassroots youth organizing on climate justice, like I think those movements are a lot more inclusive because they are grounded in justice and because they're grounded in like understanding the systemic nature of climate change. So I think those look very different from what the mainstream environmental climate movement looks like. I think when we think about like, and this is just based off of my own experience here, but like, I think if we're thinking about like kind of the more mainstream environmental and climate movement, like it's still very much focused on individual action. Like it's still focused on like recycling and like eating less meat and like turning off lights and stuff. But I think in those more mainstream spaces, I would say it's not that they're like intentionally exclusive or like intentionally like, you know, trying to alienate people. I think there's a lot that goes into making those spaces feel exclusive when they're like not exclusive on paper, if that makes sense. And I think part of it is just like what grounds our understanding of climate justice, right? Because like when I said in the beginning, like the way that I have always understood climate justice is through my own lived experience, having felt the impacts of climate change growing up in a Global South coastal nation. And that has really made me, that has really influenced the way that I see, that I experience climate change and the way that I think about it, versus the way that I feel like a lot of people see climate change here within Vancouver, which is a pretty wealthy, pretty white, and pretty like Western understanding of climate change. Like the conversations are very much focused on like, you know, electric vehicles and stuff, which is great and is needed, but like also like I have never owned a car because I don't have access to that. I don't have a license because I'm not Canadian. So like by those things, like automatically excluded from those conversations, right? So it's not that it's intentionally exclusive. It's just like the understanding of what climate means and like what climate change means and how it's impacting people leaves people out of the discussion because it's not grounded in that justice element and in that systemic understanding of climate change. So I think that's a huge piece because it might feel exclusive to folks who are struggling to make ends meet with rent, right? Like, and then how are they supposed to be expected to like, you know? So I think that's how I would say it feels exclusive sometimes. It's not an intentional thing, or at least I don't perceive it as an intentional thing. It's just your perception of what climate justice and climate change means will influence the solutions you come up with and therefore may or may not leave people out of it, right? So that's what I would say. And I think there's like, from my experience again, there's a shift right now where I feel like more and more people in kind of the more mainstream environmental movement are coming to terms with the fact that climate justice is racial justice, that we're talking about systemic issues, that we're talking about like addressing like 500 years of colonialism, that these are big picture issues rather than just like thinking about straws. And that's not to shade anyone, like it's really not. Like I know that we're all trying to like work towards a better world and a more sustainable world, but I think if we want to do that in a way that brings everyone along and that centers the experiences of most marginalized people, we really need to shift the way that we understand what's causing climate change, who is causing it, why they're causing it, and what we do about it.
Adriana spoke a little bit about elitism and the climate movement, specifically how the exclusive focus on climate science and academic language can leave out a lot of people in the conversation. She also spoke to the importance of addressing local issues and how climate change should be addressed in the context of where people live as much as it's addressed on a global level.
We cannot base our movement on academia. Yes, research is important, and yes, we need to like understand the climate science, and we need to like, you know, follow the guidance of scientists who have been working on these issues for years. Like, I'm not downplaying that at all. It's super, super important. But not everyone needs to have a science degree in order to like be a part of this conversation. And I think that's somewhere where we haven't really done, and when I say we, I mean like I guess the overall climate movement could do better, is like there's been a pretty big emphasis on climate science, which is important. Again, like not downplaying that, it is important, but I do think that if that's all we talk about, we leave out so many people. And if we don't make that like information accessible and understandable to people, then that's also a problem. If we're thinking about the communities even here in Vancouver who, like, I don't know, like, this is just, like, off the top of my head here, but, like, for example, like, Vancouver has issues with forest fires in the summer. This gives people respiratory issues. Like, this is, like, a problem when we have, like, for 2 weeks or something a year where we have the worst air quality in the world, right? That's a huge issue, and that's a huge issue for justice. Like, just thinking off the top of my head, like, what about people who are unhoused in the downtown east side, who have nothing, like who are exposed to this 24/7? That's a huge health concern, right? And I think that like if we don't start to talk about how these issues are impacting people here, we're gonna run into a lot of trouble. Like even if we're thinking about sea level rise, right? Like the seawall is not gonna go that far if the Pacific Ocean is coming for us, you know? Like and that's not something that I feel like is in the consciousness of people just yet, because obviously there's so many issues that take precedence in terms of like your day-to-day life, like being able to pay rent, especially in a pandemic. Like, you know, there's so many other issues that are more top of mind for folks, but we're also talking about the Pacific Ocean, the biggest body of water in the world, encroaching in the city, right? And that being on like a timeline within our lifetime. So I think there's like a huge issue in terms of making this information accessible and like making it real in the context of where people live. Like, it's not just like some far away thing, right? Like, when we're talking about climate change, we're not just talking about like, this is happening and like the global, yes, it is happening in the global South, but it's going to happen here too, right? And I think like that shift is really important.
Hi everyone, we're from the UBC Food Society.
Yummy.
And we're the only food club at UBC.
We're about feeding students, but also teaching them how to feed themselves. Through our restaurant outings and cooking workshops, we hope to expose you guys to the diversity of cultures, flavors, and food communities Vancouver has to offer.
So if you want to get involved, email us at foodsociety@gmail.com or check up on our website at www.ams.ubc.ca/clubs/foodsociety. Or you can even join our Facebook group.
The world is a better place because of Kim Kardashian's empire,
Cheetos,
fleece material,
and Discorder.
It's a local independent music magazine from CITR.
Which means that we can print whatever we heckin' want.
Album and live show reviews, interviews with artists, and sweet illustrations grace our pages.
And even you, listener, can contribute.
Just visit citr.ca/discorder/contribute.
You can grab it around town or read it at discorder.ca.
Forever local and forever free.
We need to understand that climate change is systemic. Like, and I think this is where I feel like it gets hard for folks, because there's like a bit of a mental block in terms of like your people's understanding and capacity generally to understand how big of a problem this is, right? Like, we're not just talking about recycling. We also need to talk about colonialism for 500 years. We also need to talk about, like, for example, like, you know, most recent event we did was like Canadian mining companies in Latin America, and like how they are destroying the environments and communities. And there's just so many layers to how this is a social justice issue and how this is impacting BIPOC communities and disabled communities and women and marginalized genders and queer people and low-income people. There's so many ways that this is an intersectional issue, but if we're just focusing exclusively on, like, you know, numbers, we're not gonna capture that. There's just so much more that goes into it. So I think really having that kind of systemic understanding and making sure that we're also holding the people accountable who need to be held accountable. Like, I think we need to be holding, you know, the CEOs of the fossil fuel industry accountable. They're the ones who have made a tremendous profit, like literally made a profit off of the destruction of the planet. Like, and when we say profit, it's like in the millions and billions of dollars, right? Why is it that we're shifting the blame towards people who are like barely making a living wage? You know, so I think our understanding of like what is causing the crisis has an impact on what our solutions are. And if our understanding of the crisis isn't intersectional, our solutions won't be either.
I think Adriana addressed the issue of sustainability so beautifully. For so long, we have allowed the issue of climate change to be discussed in terms of individual action. But the truth is, climate change has disproportionately been propagated by corporations in the global north. By shifting our focus to addressing corporations and the economic and social systems in place, we then shape more transformative solutions to create a just and sustainable future.
Although a lot needs to be done within the environmental movement, there has been a shift in the way the environmental movement addresses issues surrounding race, particularly the need to fight for Indigenous rights and the need to address the disproportionate impacts of climate change. Through Adriana's work and understanding of the environmental movement in Vancouver, she will speak about the ways in which environmental groups have started to take a more intersectional approach.
Yeah, I think there's definitely been a huge shift in the last couple of years. Like I said, when I first started, I think the conversation within kind of the more mainstream climate and environmental world was focused on like individual action. And I think we've seen, like, at least I've seen a big shift. I think a lot more people are understanding how like climate change is related to Indigenous sovereignty, for example, and how like it's disproportionately impacting BIPOC communities. I think people are like starting to get that a lot more, which is really great. And I just really want to emphasize that that is because of years and years and years of activism on behalf of BIPOC communities. It's not that like, you know, academics realized it. I think we really need to recognize the labor and the work of activists who've been talking about this for years. And it's not just, you know, one person or one community. It's like, you see this all over the world. You've been like, all of these communities have been talking about these issues for so long, and it's finally starting to get more mainstream and finally starting to get more recognition. One moment that has been a big shift was in 2018, after the climate strikes, the youth-led climate strikes. Like, I know Vancouver had like the biggest protest in its history during the climate strikes. And I think the youth movement again has been like super pivotal in people's understanding. Obviously the youth climate movement has also had a lot of critique because it is still like mostly white led in some instances, or I don't wanna say it's mostly white led. I think white activists have received more credit than BIPOC activists. That's not to say that it's not led by them, but where the credit comes in is like that part. So I think that was a huge shift in people's understanding. And I think that really mobilized people to better understand why these issues are systemic. I think another moment of shift was also two years ago, COVID has like destroyed my sense of time. But with the Wet'suwet'en blockades, when the Wet'suwet'en Nation was fighting against the pipeline, and I think that was also a wake-up call for a lot of people. And then finally, again, I think with the protests this summer and with COVID, generally speaking, making people finally realize that the world we live in is incredibly unequal in 2020. and I think the protest this summer with Black Lives Matter has also been a huge moment of reckoning for a lot of privileged white people, to be honest. And even not just white people, I think kind of more generally understanding how anti-Blackness is so pervasive and like so many communities and so many people still behave in anti-Black ways, and how anti-Blackness is also just so systemic. So I think that was also a huge wake-up call for a lot of people. So I think a lot of people over the last couple of years have really been shook. Like, so for better or for worse, but yeah, I think those movements have really kind of, yeah, have shifted people's understanding.
Do you, as a minority and a racialized person, find yourself to be like in the minority in any of these organizations or institutions? And like, how does this like impact you, if at all?
I mean, I definitely think it's had an impact on the way that I navigate kind of the climate movement. Like I said, I think it really depends on where I'm in. So I think like in like the more mainstream, more academic side of things, like, so often I'm the only one in multiple ways. Like, so often I'm the only one. I think in the more youth movements, it's a little different, but it's definitely had an impact. I think, like, to me, the most frustrating thing has been trying to talk about how these issues are intersectional and how these issues are about social justice and how this is a systemic issue, and having kind of the response, like, be, I don't say apathetic, but like almost like this doesn't fit within our final report, or like this doesn't fit within the framework that we already have, like that adds a lot of extra work and we're at capacity. Like, you know, it's like, if we're not tackling these issues in tandem or in parallel, what are we doing? And I think that has been kind of the most frustrating thing for me, is trying to talk about these issues and like not having them be seen as a priority, or talking about them like, oh yeah, we'll talk about that next time, or we'll talk about that like next year or whatever. So I think that's been a bit of a frustration for me.
We asked Adriana about some of the initiatives and policies of the organization she has been a part of. We wanted to know whether the shifting conversation around race has led to a shift in actions.
In my work, whether it be in like my like 9-to-5, or it be my like, you know, more activism and more grassroots organizing, it's something that I bring in always. Like it's to me, it's like not like a specific policy or like a specific, you know, action item per se. It's everything. And like, even with like any project that I try to take the lead on, or anything that I'm trying to discuss or work on, that's something that I try to embed, whether it be like the themes that we're talking about, the process in which we do things, the outcome. So I don't know if you want me to give you like an example, but like, I guess like you could also speak to this, Tamwani, in terms of like, for example, the kinds of events that we organize, really trying to be intentional about making sure that we have BIPOC people who are speakers, making sure that they're paid, and making sure that we're like amplifying their perspectives, or like even with like their undergraduate research projects, which you both know about, trying to make sure that those are grounded in like BIPOC communities whenever possible, trying to make sure that the topics that we discuss are also intersectional. So it's everything. It's everything that I or at least try to do. Whether I do it successfully or not is a different question, but it's in everything that I try to do.
If you made it this far, thank you so much for listening. This has been the first part of our two-part series, All of Us or None of Us. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll be speaking to members of Vancouver's environmental movement for their insight on the local grassroots environmental movement and their approaches to race and social justice issues. My name is Maya.
And my name is Tamwani.
And this has been All of Us or None of Us. Thank you.